Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
We're launching a free new Aquinas 101 digital platform. Dive into the world of St. Thomas Aquinas with a customized learning environment, certificates of achievement, interactive elements, and a redesigned digital Summa Theologiae featuring a side-by-side Latin to English translation. To be notified when the platform goes live, sign up at go.thomisticinstitute.org/new-aquinas-101. That's go.thomisticinstitute.org/new-aquinas-101. Calling all university students, immerse yourself in the ancient and medieval Roman intellectual tradition while living in the Eternal City. Apply now for our Spring 2025 Study Abroad program. The deadline is August 15th and space is limited. Don't miss out. Apply today at ThomisticInstitute.org/Rome.
As the title of my talk indicates, I'm going to be speaking to you today about St. Thomas Aquinas on the question whether God exists. And to avoid keeping you all in suspense, I'm going to cut right to the chase. His answer is yes. But I suspect you already knew that. If I were to leave the answer there, not only would this likely be the shortest talk in the history of the Thomistic Institute, but the heart of the question would remain unanswered. Because to pose a question such as this isn't simply to ask a factual point, such as, did you guys feel that earthquake today? Or is artichoke pizza down the street any good? Is it any good? I saw it reviewed online. Okay, good. I'll have to check it out. With these sorts of queries, the questioner is usually satisfied with a simple yes or no answer. By contrast, when someone asks whether God exists, something more is at stake in the asking. What the questioner really wants to know is, can you provide evidence that in fact God exists? Aquinas himself recognizes this deeper point of the question, which is clear from his work, the Summa Theologiae, Summary of Theology, in which he offers his famous five ways of proving God's existence, precisely in answer to the question whether God exists, which is the title of the very article in which he offers those proofs. The task of providing an evidentiary answer to this question might seem challenging enough, but the task is even more challenging if we consider that the very posing of the question is problematic. What exactly is it whose existence we're trying to prove? Aquinas himself frequently reminds us that in this lifetime, we do not, in fact, we cannot know God's essence or nature. To put this in other terms, we simply don't know what God is. So the problem arises, how can we even begin to prove the existence of God when we don't know what it is whose existence we're trying to prove? The task seems taller than trying to find the proverbial needle in a haystack. In that case, you at least know what it is that you're trying to find. In this case, we're trying to find whether something I know not what exists at all, and moreover, in a haystack as big as reality itself. What I intend to do today is examine how Aquinas thinks we can meaningfully answer the question whether God exists. And rather than look at any one of his arguments, instead I'm going to discuss the presuppositions and general approach that all of his arguments entail. So I've got a little slideshow for you. Here is an outline of my talk, and you can find the same outline at the top of the handout that's available in the back. You don't need to follow along with the handout, although I'll make reference to various texts, and more, it's a record of the evening. You can see the text that I'm drawing from. So my talk is going to have three parts. In the first part, I'm going to consider why Aquinas thinks that it is the case that even though we don't know what God is, we can meaningfully ask the question whether God exists. In the second part of my talk, I'm going to show how Aquinas thinks we can attempt to answer that question in a meaningful way by considering what exactly it is that he's trying to prove. And I'll provide further clarification on this point in the third part by showing what he is not trying to prove. So with that laid out, let's turn to the first part, the problematic question, whether it is. The earliest biographies of Aquinas recount that in his youth, he was already driven by questions concerning the divine. At the tender age of 5, Aquinas was sent by his parents to the Benedictine monastery of Monte Cassino, where he began his studies. And there, we're told, he repeatedly asked his masters the question, "What is God?" Notice that for the young Thomas, whether God exists wasn't the question of concern. And that makes sense if we consider that from birth, he was steeped in a life of Christian faith. So already believing that God exists, the young Aquinas wanted to know more. He wanted to know precisely what it was in which he was believing. To be clear, this question wasn't motivated by any sort of doubt on his part, but instead was seeking clarification. Already at a young age, Aquinas exemplified the Augustinian notion of faith seeking understanding. It's in this Augustinian spirit that later in life, when writing his Summa Theologiae, Aquinas would turn his attention to the more basic question whether God exists, and in answer to it, famously offer his students 5 ways of proving God's existence. Again, not in response to doubt on their part, but rather to prove through rational consideration what was already accepted on faith. Now, Aquinas is quite clear that not everything accepted on faith can be proven demonstratively. For example, he notes that the Christian doctrine of the Trinity and of the incarnation of Christ are articles of faith whose truth can be accepted on faith alone. But he contends that there are other truths of the faith that can in fact be proven, thereby providing certitude of knowledge rather than belief. And Aquinas terms such truths preambles to the articles of faith. These are truths that the articles of faith presuppose, which can, in turn, either be accepted on faith or proven philosophically. And I have a reference to that in text number 1 on the handout that you can check out. And Aquinas tells us that the existence of God is one such truth. It's a preamble to the articles of faith. One can accept that truth based on faith alone, or one can prove it. Now, these two questions that I've touched upon, namely, does God exist and what is God, these are, for Aquinas, particular instances of fundamental types of questions asked in any scientific investigation that follows Aristotelian logical methodology. In his Posterior Analytics, Aristotle presents 4 fundamental scientific questions that can be asked. Is it? In other words, does it exist? What is it? Is it a fact that it's such? And why is it such? To get a sense of these 4 questions, let's consider the nature of whales. As I like to bring up to my students, one activity that whales engage in is nursing their young. That might be surprising to someone unschooled on their nature who thinks that a whale is a fish. But perhaps one day she visits SeaWorld and sees firsthand a mother beluga whale nursing her calf, as in this video. She now knows the fact of the matter. Whales nurse their young, which is an answer to the 3rd of the 4 Aristotelian scientific questions. Whales nurse their young, but why? Well, as it turns out, this activity isn't one that's performed by fish. In observing the whale's behavior, this person discovers that a whale, in fact, has a non-fish nature. And now the person can investigate further the why. The fourth of the Aristotelian scientific questions. If she knows some basic zoology, she might realize that whales do so because they're mammals. In answering this question, the person begins to know better what the whale is, the second of the four Aristotelian questions. But notice, to be able to answer any of these three questions that we just ran through, the person first needs to know that whales exist. The answer to the first of Aristotle's four questions. But how does she know that? Observation is certainly one avenue. People can see whales either at SeaWorld or out on the open sea itself. But the matter is more complex for the investigation of things that we haven't yet observed, or moreover, things that we can't observe. To answer the is it question about these things, we instead need to prove that they exist. But how? Following Aristotle, Aquinas acknowledges a conundrum. On the one hand, it seems that to prove that something is, you need to know what it is. But on the other hand, to know what it is, it seems that you first need to know that it is. If I were to ask you, hey, do you know if the Campophilus Principalis exists? Odds are that you'd reply, what's that? Unless, that is, you're an ornithologist or an avid birdwatcher, in which case you might know that I'm talking about the ivory-billed woodpecker, a species of bird considered critically endangered and likely extinct since it hasn't been observed in decades. And if you do know that much, namely that it's a bird, you at least know something about what it is that we're talking about, and you could then begin an investigation into whether it exists. And the reason you could do even that much without being a trained ornithologist is that you've encountered birds and have a general understanding of what they are. You've seen them and you've heard them. As the medievals like to say, there's nothing in the intellect that was not first in the senses, meaning that the senses are the gateway for our knowledge. Following Aristotle, they held that the mind is by nature a blank slate on which knowledge is, metaphorically speaking, written through sensory experience. And Aquinas tells us on a number of occasions that the proper object of the human intellect is the quiddity, the whatness, the nature of a sensible thing. In other words, the nature of something that can be grasped by the senses. Now, that's all well and good for establishing what a woodpecker is and whether it exists, but what about God? For Christians, at least, and many other believers, God is considered to be an immaterial being, and as such, can't be experienced in a sensory way. Moreover, God is traditionally identified as an infinite being that transcends the comprehension of our finite intellects. Still, we might wonder whether the descriptors I just gave, immaterial, infinite, don't those tell us, at least to a minimal degree, what God is? In fact, Aquinas says no. Instead, these sorts of terms more precisely indicate what he's not. To speak of a being as immaterial is to say that it's not material. To speak of it as infinite is to say that it's not finite. In using these terms, we're simply negating the notions of materiality and finitude that we acquire first through sensation. Thus, Aquinas maintains that in this lifetime, at least, we cannot know God's essence or nature, which is again to say that we can't know what he is. And so we return to the question I raised at the outset of my talk in the context of this philosophical conundrum. You can see that illustrated in figure 2 on the handout. To know that something is, You need to know what it is, but to know what something is, you need to know that it is. How do we break out of this seemingly vicious circle? Well, it would help to note first that this problem isn't unique to the investigation of the divine and immaterial. We find the same problem arising at times in the study of nature. Consider that according to physicists today, the sort of matter that can be observed and studied seems to account for only a fraction of the total mass, energy, density of the universe. What accounts for the rest? Physicists have hypothesized a sort of dark matter, which they call dark precisely because it has so far been undetectable. Notice that the proponents of this theory don't in fact know what dark matter is, but surely they at least know what they mean by the name, by the term dark matter, or else they wouldn't be able meaningfully to talk about it. Implicitly, these scientists are drawing on a distinction between what Aquinas and other scholastic thinkers refer to as the quid rei, Latin for the whatness of a thing. When he's talking about the whatness of a thing, he's talking about its nature, versus the quid nomines, the whatness of the name, what some word is intended by us to signify or mean. And you can see that illustrated in figure 3 on the handout. The quid nomines, the whatness of the name of what physicists term dark matter, is the aforementioned stuff whose nature, or quid rei, they hope to discern one day. So they don't know what dark matter is, but they know what they mean by the name. It's that other stuff that fills in the blank, the gap, for the stuff that we do know, which can't account for the total mass energy of the universe. So here then we see a way out of the seemingly vicious circle depicted in figure 2. To prove that something is, you need to know what it is, but this doesn't mean that you need to know what its nature or essence is. According to Aquinas, it's sufficient simply to know what we mean by the term. So to prove that some type of thing exists, we can simply provide what he refers to as a nominal definition, a definition of the name, a nominal definition of what we're looking for, rather than a more robust definition of the very nature of that type of thing. And you can see him talking about that in text 2 on the handout. And the same is the case when it comes to our investigation of God. Aquinas tells us, as regards God, we cannot know whether he exists unless we know something about what he is. Of course, we can't know his whatness. Well, unless we know something about what he is in some confused way. The question next is, well, how do we form the right sort of confused understanding to provide us with a sufficient nominal definition of the word God, such that we're searching for the right thing in trying to prove his existence? There are many different conceptions of God across time, culture, and religions. Idolaters of old worshipped statues. The ancient Greeks were polytheists whose gods were considered corporeal beings. Christians are monotheists, but Trinitarians, leading some fellow monotheistic Muslims to accuse them of being polytheists. Even atheists have their implicit preconceptions about what it is that they're rejecting. And those preconceptions may not line up with the understanding of those whom they're trying to refute. As I like to say to atheists, guess what? I don't believe in the same God you don't believe in. We have to be on the same page here to know what we're talking about. So to answer the question whether God exists, we need to be clear about what we mean by the word God. Only once we have a sufficient nominal definition of this term, can we make a satisfactory attempt to prove that what it signifies, in fact, exists. So I move to the second part of my talk, what Aquinas is trying to prove. It's going to turn out God as the first cause. given Aquinas' position that we can't know what God is in his nature, any argument for his existence that attempts to proceed from what God is in himself or what we might suppose him to be is problematic. So he rejects his great respect for St. Anselm, but he rejects Anselm's so-called ontological argument that seeks to prove the existence of God from his nature as something than which nothing greater can be thought. Similarly, Aquinas would have disagreed with the approach of the later Duns Scotus, whose efforts to prove the existence of God as a being that is infinite in his nature. So he's setting out to prove the existence of an infinite being. To be clear, Aquinas does accept both of these attributes as belonging to God. What he rejects is the approach of presuming them prior to proving God's existence. Moreover, neither does Aquinas consider it appropriate to turn to revelation for his nominal definition of God, even though he accepts on faith what revelation teaches about God. An argument employing a definition of God taken from Scripture would be circular, trying to prove his existence based upon the authority of the word of a God whose existence the argument is trying to prove. Instead, Aquinas' approach is to turn again to the scientific methodology laid out by Aristotle in his Posterior Analytics. According to Aristotle, science entails what he calls demonstrative knowledge, the certainty that some conclusion is true because it has been deduced by means of a valid syllogism with premises that are themselves necessary, universal, and true. And Aristotle identifies two sorts of demonstrations. One sort deduces not only that something is the case, but more importantly also why. As the medievals term it, this is a so-called propter quid demonstration. And as Aquinas explains, following Aristotle, this is text 4 on the handout, this sort of argument offers a causal explanation of some fact that is deduced. So consider my earlier syllogistic example regarding whales, which we can present formally as such. All mammals nurse their young. All whales are mammals. Therefore, all whales nurse their young. Now, I'm not going to overload you with all of the details of Aristotelian logic, but I will point out this much. The term mammal that I have highlighted in this argument is what logicians call the middle term, and it shows the logical connection between the subject of the conclusion, whales, and the predicate, in this case, nurses their young. In a so-called propter quid demonstration, the middle term is a cause that accounts for why the conclusion is true. To put this into more ordinary language, in response to the question, why is it that whales nurse their young? The answer would be, because they are mammals. It is the mammalian nature of whales that provides the causal account explaining why the conclusion is true. But sometimes, as we've seen, we don't know the nature of the subject that we're investigating. In such cases, we can't offer this sort of propter quid demonstration whether what we're investigating is dark matter or God himself. Fortunately, Aristotle offers another way of proceeding in the investigation of such things. As Aquinas explains, when an effect is better known to us than its cause, we can proceed in the inverse manner of a propter quid argument, this time starting with the effect and reasoning back to the cause, employing what the medievals call a quia demonstration. Consider the following example, my own, not Aquinas's. You've had a hard day at work or study and could really go for a refreshing beer, at least if you're of age. A friend of yours hands you a bottle of a label you've never heard of before. It's called O'Doul's. You find it refreshing enough, but as you finish your second one, you notice that it isn't taking the edge off from your day. And suddenly it dawns on you, this isn't really beer at all. Before you even look at the label to confirm your suspicions, you've implicitly reasoned as follows. All non-intoxicating beer is non-alcoholic. All O'Doul's is non-intoxicating beer. So all O'Doul's is non-alcoholic. In this example, you would again be reasoning in a deductive manner, but this time the highlighted middle term is not a cause, but rather an effect that offers evidence revealing the truth of the conclusion. As Aristotle indicates, with a quia demonstration such as this, we again have certitude. We have certitude that the conclusion is true, but this time we merely know that it is true and not why, because we don't know the cause. So in my example, when you reach the conclusion that O'Doul's must be non-alcoholic, you're left to wonder, why, for the love of God, would anybody brew non-alcoholic beer? Of course, there are explanations to tell us why, but my point is that these explanations are not brought out in the premises of the argument. We only know the fact of the matter. So you're wondering at this point, how is any of this relevant for our question of whether God exists? Well, Aquinas tells us how. Because from any effect, it's possible to demonstrate the existence of its proper cause. And the reason is that an effect depends upon a cause. Philosophers term this the principle of causality, namely that every effect, precisely insofar as it is an effect, depends upon some cause. So in that moment of dependence, it's clear that if something exists as an effect in some respect, not only does it have to have a cause, but also that the relevant cause must exist. As an example of such an inference, consider that we suddenly hear a knocking at the door. We know that sound isn't sufficient to account for itself, so there must be a cause to account for it. If the knocking exists, we can reason in a quia manner that, for want of a better term, a door knocker must exist. Now I'm going to date myself, but as the 1980s rock band Men at Work once sang, "Who can it be knocking at my door?" You'll have to go and Google that one. That, who is it knocking at the door? That we can't figure out by simply reasoning from effect to cause. We can't even know if it's a human being. What can we label it? The door knocker. So even though the effect can't reveal who or even what the cause is in its nature, it at least reveals that there is a cause, that the cause exists. And whether physicists today realize it or not, it's this sort of quia line of reasoning that they're employing in investigations such as the search for dark matter. From various astrophysical observations, such as gravitational effects that can't be explained by accepted theories of gravity, they infer that there must exist a cause, some sort of matter that can't be detected, at least presently, but that must exist. Do they know from these effects what dark matter is? No. And Aquinas contends that in a similar way, even though we don't know God's nature, it is possible for us to reason in a quia manner from the existence of various effects back to the existence of a cause that we would call God. And this is the methodology that he employs in each of his famous five ways for proving God's existence. He starts with a given effect, such as in the so-called first way argument, motion, and argues back to the existence of a first cause in some respect, such as an unmoved first mover. And you can see a diagram of all five of the five ways and how they start with the various effects and reason to a cause, first cause, in figure five of my handout. And in text five, I have all five of the five ways translated. To prove the existence of a cause that is truly first and uncaused, Aquinas maintains is to prove the existence of something that transcends all things. And in that respect, it's unlike them. So here we find an answer to our earlier question regarding the definition of what God is. As I've noted, Aquinas thinks that it's impossible for us to discern the whatness of God's very nature. But we can at least know what we mean by the term we are employing. As he explains, whatever words we use to describe God are taken from his effects. For example, when we call him good, true, or wise. But what about when we call him God? Aquinas contends that what this name should signify is as follows. Something above all existing things that is the principle, meaning the cause of all existing things, and removed from all existing things. For this, he contends, is what those who use the name God intend to signify. In short, it's the existence of this sort of being that Aquinas is trying to prove in each and every one of his arguments for the existence of God. So now that we have, I hope, a sense of what Aquinas is trying to prove to avoid misunderstandings regarding his project, we need next to get a better sense of that project by considering what he's not trying to prove. So I turn to the third part of my talk. What Aquinas is not trying to prove, the singular God in his existence. You probably have a sense so far that as straightforward as Aquinas' arguments for God's existence may at first seem to be, there is, in fact, a lot going on behind the scenes. People who are unfamiliar with his methodology can easily misread these proofs. On the one hand, leading the sympathetic reader to assent to a conclusion that Aquinas himself doesn't reach, and on the other hand, leading the opponent to reject an argument that Aquinas never made. There are two common mistakes that people understandably make when reading Aquinas' arguments. One of them is their assumption that Aquinas intends to prove the existence of God. The other is the assumption that he intends his proofs to prove the existence of God. That was very cryptic. Let me put that less cryptically. One error is mistaking the subject that the argument is about, namely God. And the other error is mistaking what is attributed to that subject, namely existence. So let's unpack this and see what's going on here. And we'll start with the first of these two, as I say, commonly mistaken assumptions. When I say that it's a mistake to read Aquinas as attempting to prove the existence of God in arguments like his five ways, what I have in mind is the common assumption that he's trying to prove the existence of some individual who goes by the name of God, as though that's a proper name, like Greg Doolin or Dominic Dashka. Proper names signify an individual being as such, and thus can't be said of any other individual except metaphorically, like he's real Einstein. But Aquinas is clear that the name God is not a proper name of God. It's not a personal name. It's not a proper name of God taken as an individual. The closest thing he suggests to a proper name for God might be the Tetragrammaton of the Hebrews, which he seems to consider to be unpronounceable. Instead, Aquinas tells us that this name, God, is what we would now in English call a common noun, like the names human and animal, which can be said of more than one thing. Aquinas explains that the name God is like other common nouns in that it is intended to signify not an individual as such, but a kind of nature, namely the divine nature. So to call something God or a God is to say that that thing has a divine nature, is a, if you will, haver of divinity. Now granted, What's the divine nature? We don't know that nature. But it's still coherent for us to give a name for that status of having that nature that we don't know. As noted, taking that name from the effects, just as physicists give the name dark matter to dark matter. As Aquinas clarifies, it's precisely because the name God is a common noun that for Christians, it can commonly be said of each of the three persons of the Trinity in a meaningful way. Each is a haver of divinity. Of course, there's only one being, but there are three persons. It's a mystery. But it's a common name, God. Moreover, it's because the name God is a common name that polytheists can speak of gods in the plural, although according to what Aquinas describes as a mistaken opinion. And it's also why the monotheist can meaningfully enter into conversation with polytheists to point out their error. In short, this semantic consideration of what the term God signifies reveals that Aquinas' intention in arguments like the five ways is not to conclude to the existence immediately of the one true God. As I say, at least not directly and immediately. And this reading is further confirmed by a consideration, again, of Aquinas' logical methodology in these arguments. Following Aristotle, he holds that there's no scientific knowledge of singulars as such. Science concerns universals. Science concerns nature. So he tells us that there can be no demonstrations, no logical proofs of singulars. For that reason, we can't offer a demonstration that an individual such as Dominic exists. The best we can do is point at him, say, there he is. By contrast, we can offer demonstrations that a certain kind of thing, such as humans, exist by proving that there is something out there in reality that has a human nature. The point I'm getting at is that unlike a Duns Scotus, who later attempts to offer a single knockdown argument for the existence of the individual, one true God, Aquinas takes a different approach in his arguments following his Aristotelian methodology. Namely, Aquinas tries to prove instead that there exists some being that has the divine nature, some haver of divinity. For this reason, if we look at his five ways, we find that none of them explicitly concludes to the existence of only one God. Now, to be clear, as I've already indicated, Aquinas does hold that in actual fact, there can be only one haver of divinity, properly speaking. My point is that fact isn't explicitly signified for him by the common name God. For Aquinas, the unicity of God is a conclusion that can be reached only after the existence of God, only after the existence of a God has been proven, namely as a sort of corollary. So it's noteworthy, if you look at figure 6 on the handout, I give you a little table of contents, I think of the first 25 questions of the Summa Theologiae. Notice it's not until question 11 that Aquinas establishes God's unicity. 9 questions after the article in which he presents the five ways. In sum, the immediate conclusion of these arguments isn't to the existence of an individual entity whose proper name is God, but rather the conclusion is that there exists at least one being with a kind of nature, namely divine, that corresponds to what Aquinas thinks the name God signifies, namely something whose nature is such that it can be and in fact is a first uncaused cause that is so removed from its effects that it transcends them. With that said, for these arguments to fully cash out as genuine proofs of God's existence, they need to conclude to the sort of first cause, it will turn out, of which there can be only one. And again, that's what Aquinas proceeds to show in the questions and articles that follow the five ways. Now, you'll also recall that I made the provocative and cryptic claim that none of Aquinas' arguments conclude to the existence of God. This time, emphasis on the word existence. So what the heck do I mean by that? Well, here, once again, we need to step back to consider what it is precisely that's being proven in a logical demonstration. Properly speaking, it's neither a thing nor any of its attributes. To illustrate, let's return to my example syllogism about whales. We wouldn't say to somebody, prove whales. Prove what about whales? Nor would we say, prove nurse their young. What nurse their young? Rather, what we would say is, prove that whales nurse their young. In short, what I'm trying to bring out here is that in a logical demonstration, what is properly sought is evidence that some statement is true. The statement, whales nurse their young. Is that true? Prove that that is true. And the same is the case for any demonstration one would attempt to make about God. Whatever it is that Aquinas tries to prove about him, it's about some statement concerning God. For example, that the statement God is good is true. That the statement God is infinite is true. That he is wise. And so forth and so on. And similarly regarding his existence, what Aquinas attempts to prove is the truth that the proposition, the statement God exists, is true. So we find that the conventional translation of Aquinas's words leading up to the five ways is kind of inaccurate. In the Benzinger edition that, you know, we'll find in textbooks or online that English readers commonly turn to, we find the translation, the existence of God can be proven in five ways. But Aquinas here doesn't use the words existence of God. You can see that in text 5 and in the appendix on the handout. Now, don't panic. I'm not going to bore you with, what the Latin says is deum esse. And as I say, don't panic. I'm not going to bore you with a Latin lesson other than to clarify that this phrase, deum esse, is an instance of a grammatical construction used to indicate an indirect statement, the sort of that statement I was just talking about. Prove that this statement is true, that God exists. To be even more precise, I should note that Aquinas, in fact, doesn't use the verb to exist at all. In Latin, that's existere, where we get our English word to exist from. Instead, he uses the verb esse, which is better translated as the English infinitive to be. With that in mind, the lines leading into the five ways arguments most accurately reads, it can be proven in five ways that God is. Now, at this point, you might well be thinking that Doolin is just being a finicky translator here and making a distinction without a difference. Surely the verb to be is a synonym for the verb to exist. Consider Hamlet famously asking about his own existence, to be or not to be, that is the question. Or consider Descartes, for whom there was no question when he famously pronounced his existence to both himself and the world when he said, I think, therefore I am. But we need to be careful here, because for both the English verb to be and the Latin esse that it translates, the existence of a thing isn't always what is signified by the word. Consider the following example. You meet someone who, having just learnt about the Danish prince, asks you, you know, when did Hamlet live? Knowing your Shakespeare, you reply, oh, don't you know? Hamlet is a fictional character. And hearing this news, the person might react with surprise, saying, is he? And without missing a beat, you reply, he is. Now, in saying this, surely you wouldn't mean that Hamlet exists, because you just told the person that he's fictional. So what would you mean? Well, Aquinas offers some clarification here. On a number of occasions, he tells us that the verb to be, or esse in Latin, can be said in different ways. And you can see a list of those ways in text number 10 on your handout. One such way is the existential sense of to be used by both Hamlet and Descartes, meaning to exist. But another way that it's commonly used is as what both grammarians and logicians call a copula, when various forms of the verb to be join together a subject and predicate in a proposition. This is how the word is functions in the statement. Hamlet is a fictional character. It combines the notion of Hamlet and fictional character, indicating that they rightly belong together. And Aquinas tells us that what the copulative use of the word is signifies is that the asserted proposition is true. So sometimes is and to be signifies true. These notions truly go together. And similarly, in your reply to the question, is Hamlet fictional? The is in your answer, he is, also signifies that what was said is true, namely the prior statement about Hamlet. So, you know, why am I going through this semantic analysis when considering Aquinas' arguments for the existence of God? Surely when he says that he intends to prove that God is, the is signifies existence, right? But there's a problem here. It turns out that the God, whose existence Aquinas is trying to prove, is a being whose nature is identical with his very existence. In short, what Aquinas will ultimately show is that God's whatness is his isness. So as an objector contends, wait a second, if you claim that you can prove that God exists and that you know this about his existence, then you're claiming that you can also come to know what God is. You can see this in text 11. But recall that in this lifetime, we can't know what God is. So the argument of the objector goes, it seems impossible to know by means of the certitude of the demonstration that God is. In response to this concern, Aquinas grants that we can neither prove nor know the is of God that is his very existence. But he reassures us, when we are attempting to demonstrate that God is, we aren't employing the existential sense of the word to be. Rather, Aquinas contends, it is that copulative sense according to which the term is signifies that a proposition is true. Okay, I've dumped a lot of semantics and logic on you. This is rather abstract and somewhat obscure, so let me try to lay out the implications in simpler terms. What Aquinas is reminding us is that we don't have a firsthand experience of God or of his existence, unlike your experience of me right now. You can rightfully judge about me that Greg Doolin exists, and moreover, that Doolin exists as a human. Here, we are asserting something experienced about an individual. But as I've noted, you can't offer a philosophical demonstration that an individual such as me exists. By contrast, as I've also noted, Aquinas holds that it is possible to prove that something with a given kind of nature exists. How? Well, again, by reasoning from effect back to cause in a quia demonstration. Consider my earlier example of the ivory-billed woodpecker, which currently isn't observed. But if presented with sufficient evidence of the unique effects of such a woodpecker that you did observe, namely if you did observe the effects, for example, their distinctive bird call, and if you found recently built distinctive ivory-billed woodpecker nests, then you would be justified in inferring their existence. But notice, you wouldn't conclude that this individual woodpecker, Woody Woodpecker, exists, but rather that there exists some bird out there that's got to have that nature, some ivory-billed woodpecker. you would know of their existence, but not directly. The conclusion that an ivory-billed woodpecker exists, in fact, turns out to be a shorthand referencing the truth of the following proposition. Something out there is an ivory-billed woodpecker. And in this proposition as well, the is doesn't signify that a given individual exists, but rather that it's true to combine the notion of something. Aquinas will call that word a vague individual, and the notion of ivory-billed woodpecker. So what this proposition is really asserting is that something out there has the nature of an ivory-billed woodpecker. Of course, for that something to have that nature, it must exist. But notice that that existence isn't directly asserted in this statement. It is only implied in as much as the truth of the proposition presupposes the fact that such a bird exists. And we find Aquinas indicating that something similar is occurring in demonstrations of the existence of God. Recall his position that the word God isn't a proper name like Greg Doolin, but the name of a kind of nature, namely of the divine nature. What's that? As we've seen, we don't know. But we can signify what we mean by the name, namely that a haver of divinity is a thing that is a first, uncaused, transcendent cause. So whereas you can rightly assert of me that Doolin is, signifying that I exist because you have firsthand knowledge of my existence, Aquinas indicates that by contrast, when we assert that God exists, we are instead really asserting that something is a God, and that we're doing so according to the truth sense of to be. In short, we're signifying that it's true that something in reality has a divine nature. And the truth of that statement, of course, presupposes that a God in fact exists. But again, God's existence is merely implied or presumed by the statement God is. It's not asserted. In short, Aquinas's position is that through demonstrations, we can come to know the fact that God exists indirectly from his effects, as he indicates at the end of text 10. So we can sum up Aquinas's line of reasoning for each of his five ways and any other of his arguments for the existence of God by showing what I call the meta-argument, that they all follow. Definitionally, he's saying what we mean by the word God is a first uncaused transcendent God. Excuse me, cause. So a first uncaused transcendent cause is a God. Something out there is a first uncaused transcendent cause, so something is a God. Now notice that the first premise there, or major premise, again, that's the nominal definition of the word God that Aquinas provides. The second or minor premise, well, that needs to be proven, and that's what he's trying to do in each of the five-way arguments and every other arguments. He's trying to prove, for example, the prime mover in the first-way argument, or in the fourth-way argument, a maximal cause of being, of the existence of all things. Regardless of the specifics, if it is a first uncaused transcendent cause, whose existence has been proven, Aquinas contends that in that respect, what has been proven is that there is indeed a God. Now, for the person of faith, this approach, as I've described it, might be disappointing if this person were expecting a proof that immediately arrives at the one true God of faith. In fact, the language of a God might seem particularly troubling, as though implying that there is or could be more than one. But the believer shouldn't be thrown either by Aquinas' language or his reasoning. Recall again that even though Aquinas is simply attempting to prove the existence of something with a given kind of nature, it's going to turn out that, in fact, there can be only one thing with the divine nature, because it's going to turn out that there can be only one first uncaused transcendent cause.
But we need to do more work after the proofs to show that. As a parallel, consider what occurs in the Catholic Church with the election of a new pope. There's a period during every papal conclave when the Catholic faithful do not yet know whether there is a pope or not. And then finally, from the central balcony of St. Peter's Basilica, it is announced to the world, Habemus Papam, we have a pope. At that point, we know that someone is the pope, but we don't know who. We don't know his proper name. And that's because, like the name God, the name pope is a common name. So the pronouncement, we have a pope, doesn't assert something about an individual as such, Benedict or Francis. Nevertheless, it still implies something about an individual because at any given time, there can be only one pope. And we find something similar occurring at the conclusion of each of Aquinas' arguments for the existence of God. We now know, Aquinas claims, that something is a God because we've proven that there must be something that is a first cause. And as with the pope, there can be only one of it. Does this God of philosophical demonstration line up with a one true God of faith? Aquinas would ultimately say yes. But notice, it does not belong to the philosopher as such to tell the believer that this being is in fact the God in whom she believes. For the philosopher, considered simply as a philosopher, doesn't speak from the vantage point of faith. So in the end, it belongs to the believer to affirm whether any given philosophical demonstration, Aquinas's or otherwise, has concluded to the divinity that she believes in. And if so, to pronounce to her satisfaction, we have a God. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.